Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this is a show about the expansion of consciousness. And I'm in one of the centers of conscious expansion here in Sedona, Arizona. And we have a great show tonight with some of the top UFO experts, researchers, parts of family traditions on tonight's show. I just want to give a little UFO news here that at the end of May, Contact in the Desert will be happening in Joshua Tree. That's May 29th to the 31st. Some of the great researchers in the field, Richard Dolan, Linda Moultonhouse, Stanton Friedman, will be there. And also, what else? Oh, I'm showing the movie, Travis Walton's documentary in New York City, April 12th. If you know who Travis Walton is, you know he is probably the best documented UFO contact case in history. He was missing for 5 days, aboard a ship, witness being taken off. They did a Hollywood movie called Fire in the Sky about him, but this just recently, Jennifer Stein and Peter Robbins released a documentary about that. So Travis, the name of the documentary is called Travis. It will be shown April 12th in New York City at Reflection Studio. You can find out about that on newrealities.com or check my Facebook, Alan Steinfeld. And we have a little more news that will come up in the show, but let me introduce tonight's guest. Here with me on the line is Jesse Marcel III. And he, you know, sometimes you discover UFOs, sometimes they come to you, but he was born into a family lineage of UFO researchers that he just, in a sense, inherited. His grandfather was probably the person who found the wreckage at Roswell, New Mexico. And Jesse the Third spent a lot of time with his grandfather. We're going to be hearing about just really what his grandfather, Jesse Marcel, learned and found out about that wreckage. And I also interviewed his father, your father, Jesse Marcel Jr., a couple of years ago. Beautiful guy. He passed away recently, but really one of my best interviews about the Roswell situation. And here in the studio are the Hertogs, Doctors Desiree and J.J. Hertog, who have been researching the UFO phenomena for the last 40 years. They're linguistics. They travel the world, in a sense, devoting their time to future science. And UFOs are a big part of the future. And they've devoted a lot of their research and their time to that. So that's the foundation of tonight's show. But let's just start with, if you don't mind, Jesse, Desiree has found some interesting research that NASA is just put out today. Desiree, do you want to talk about that?
Right. Well, it's an exciting time that we're living in. There's many things going on. And just today, I think the whole test hasn't really concluded, but NASA was testing something that looked very much like a flying saucer. In fact, they called it a type of flying saucer, and it's called the LDSD. And that actually stands for the Low Density Supersonic Decelerator. And this is something that they're ready in a short time, they hope, to go to Mars. It's just being tested right now between California and eventually Hawaii.
Do you know about that, Jesse?
No, I'm not familiar with it. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I've heard about it. I don't really understand. It's low density supersonic deceleration technology. I've heard about it. I don't know a lot about it, though.
This is really going to be the landing technology for going to Mars, and it's being tested really right now. So that's really exciting.
And it looks like a UFO or like a saucer shape, the classic UFO site. If you go to the NASA website, you could see this object.
Google LDSD. It's like LSD, but with a D in it.
But I mean, I want to get to your history first, and then we'll talk to Dr. J.J. Hertog here, who's been researching UFOs since the 70s. He knew J. Allen Hynek. He was one of the early researchers. But you have something to say before we talk to
Jesse? Well, I wanted to say this with respect to Travis Walton.
Yes.
Allen Hynek and I were together in Brasilia.
Yes.
Brazil, back in the late 70s, discussing the authenticity of the Travis Walton story. Mm-hmm. Is quite apparent because all of the world researchers were gathered at that point to find that there's was an event that wouldn't go away. People could not dismiss it or laugh it off. Even Tracy Tremé's Fire in the Sky had some weaknesses, but nonetheless, the strength and testimony of Travis himself and the details that there were several life forms that were there made a sterling impression upon all the researchers in the field. And so we feel very honored to recognize also Jesse Marcel, the grandfather of Jesse III, who has contributed so much to this science. It's no longer just a phenomena, it's a science. Well, and this is why there needs to be a scientific discipline devoted to this to distinguish the different levels of information.
Do you have anything to say about the science of ufology? Anything, Jesse, before I go into your history?
Yeah, we can go that. You know, I've been talking to several people, working with one of the museums, an extension of the Smithsonian, and they're actually interested in the same, exactly what you're talking about here. We're trying to assemble a team of people that look at these using a scientific method and create, and not, I hate to say the word legitimacy, but actually go through a very specific set of rules, and, you know, as far as if something like, if something's found, an object's found, another crash site, that kind of thing, but go about it with using a scientific method and, but they're exactly right. We're moving into a new age as far as how our research is going to take place.
Well, it's very exciting, and I want to go back to, you know, really, you're the original, your family is original in the sense of founding investigators, and there's that look on your grandfather's face, right? You know what I'm talking about? He's holding this material. His eyes are up, and it's like he probably was told, oh, just say this is a fake, and it's like, you know, something else is going on. How do you describe that picture, that moment with your grandfather there? What do you say about it?
It is one of the interesting things. If you take a look at that picture, is, you know, when somebody's taking a picture of you, do you look at the camera, or do you look to the guy to your right or left that's barking orders at you? Yeah. And if you look at that picture, you'll notice that my grandfather doesn't even look into the camera. It's always right at whoever's yelling at him about what to do, and that's what was happening. He entered that room. Actually, with a light heart, he thought, you know, this is amazing. We're actually going to let the public know about what we found out there. And after he'd entered the room and saw the kind of debris that was there, he realized, well, that's not going to really happen. And then when he was told to basically hold this stuff and smile, his face says it all. If you look at it closely, we did a lot of studies on the pictures, did, you know, some enhancements and colorize them, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of tells within that picture itself, or the two pictures that he's in that are kind of famous. But, you know, the biggest ones that are very obvious is just it was completely set up. And like I said, and it was my sister Denise Marcel that had pointed out one time, you notice he never looks at the camera. It's like I said, he's always looking to his commander, who's there telling him to sit up or to you know, basically make this look right.
Well, you're right, and I sort of felt in a way bad for your grandfather because, you know, he was just trying to be a good soldier, but he couldn't fake the orders that he probably had to do to satisfy his commander.
Right, the eyes say it all. The body language, although it's still a photograph, shows Ramey on one hand wants to say this is simply aerial weather balloons testing, and your grandfather remarkably has that eye vision in his pose, saying that there's something more that meets the eye.
So why don't you go into your, history with your grandfather? Like, when did you realize he was, in a way, such an important person because he really, you know, handled this material? I mean, and what was your relationship with your grandfather? How much did he really tell you? Do you want to tell us that story?
Yeah, I can go through it. You know, really, it was, you know, by the time the late 70s came around, it was in early 80s. It was common speak within our immediate family growing up in Montana. And what's interesting is when you're so embedded, when it's around you, you never even you don't think of it as being out of the ordinary or even a fantastic event. It was just, you know, this is just our family history, and we didn't look at it any different as kids growing up. Tell us a story about quite a few times. Like, we'd sit there with our father watching Star Trek at dinner, and we'd be talking about Roswell. And you know, the difference was, obviously, you know, Star Trek is science fiction, but I'd be sitting there in dinner, and I'd be thinking about that, alien boy at a table having dinner on some other planet. And that was just a comfortable thought. It was accepted. There was nothing even strange about it. In fact, you know, we never even, you know, as far as in our family, we talked about it all the time. Now, as you talk about, as far as my grandfather goes, we'd spent our summers in Louisiana several, and I was lucky enough that my grandfather kind of taught me how to fish. And so we spent a lot of time on the banks of a bayou behind his home in Louisiana. And so I learned a lot more about the story from him and my father too. You know, learn the ins and the outs, you know, like I always tell people, he would start going into part of the story and then he kind of get a twinkle in his eye and wink at you and tell you, you know, and there's so much more and I wish I could tell you.
Wait. So you mean he was still silent to not even tell his family, even towards the end of his life?
Oh, there were parts of it definitely that he would not tell his family.
Like, and what do you think they were?
When my father was writing his book, we were going through all kinds of military records, diaries, all those kind of things, and we actually picked on something that wasn't out there at the time, and that he and his commander both went for a 3-week vacation right after this happened at the end of July. He was supposed to go back to Houma. His commander was, you know, Cab was supposed to go. I'm not quite sure where he's supposed to go, but they were supposed to go off. But in reality, my father is he's saying, you know, they never went back to Houma for a vacation. That didn't happen, and you can surmise that they both went back, you know, back to where the debris was and made the biological, you know, debris, that everything, and did more investigating, more maybe crowd control. My grandfather's position was, you know, as intelligence officer, his part of what he's supposed to do was to, you know, keep informed and also inform the, you know, how do we keep this under wraps? And, you know, even though, you know, he thought it needed to be brought out at that point and the world needed to know about it, he went back to his position as an officer. At that point, he was raised to a colonel, you know, those kind of things. And he was part of that position where, you know, Roswell just kind of disappeared off the map, at least this portion of it. So he was right in the heart of it during that 3 weeks. And it's during that 3 weeks that he became immersed, in more of what happened when Roswell. Because he was involved, as if people are aware, in the first crash site and not so much in the second one. But
if I can interrupt for a minute, Jesse, I know we were together in Brazil, and you mentioned this. This is something that's not known to everybody unless you've really delved into Roswell, that there probably was 2 crash sites. Now, did he confirm that with you when you were talking with him? You were saying it kind of matter-of-factly.
Absolutely. There was 2 crash sites, and it looks like there was actually 3. But there was 2 main ones. The second one, he did not go out to the field to look at. It was done, you know, they kind of compartmentalized everything. One is, you know, he was involved in the first crash site. There was lots of debris. There was even some biological material in that crash site. The second one is where a lot of the stories came of, you know, a living being actually running around, and also, you know, several that had perished and that sort of thing. But his response to that, and this with my father, was pretty straightforward. He said he would tell you that I wasn't the one on the site, but you can believe what those people said, and I could be a person that would know that.
But was he ever silenced? I mean, was there years where he didn't talk about any of it, or was Roswell always known as a fact? I'm just curious about that early history, about that.
Within our family, it was definitely a fact early on. When my grandfather came out and was more public about it, it happened to me, you know, probably people know Stanton Friedman interviewed him, but before Stanton Friedman interviewed him, he was my grandfather was a huge ham radio fan. Mm-hmm. So he'd spend a lot of his evenings, you know, on the ham radio talking to people, and somebody somewhere recognized him as Jesse Marcel and knew enough from somewhere to ask him about, you know, this UFO crash. What was that about? And that was really where he first came out about it. Like I said, that was in the year that led up to where Stanton Friedman caught wind of it and got embedded in the story and brought it out. But go ahead.
No, I was saying Stanton Friedman takes credit for bringing out the Roswell stuff. So,
he did. And there was actually – he was the first one that did it and did a very legitimate job. there was before Stan, you know, there was offers from a magazine wanted to do it. My grandfather did not want to put it out that way. He actually was kind of a side story, a good friend of Carol O'Connor, and they're buddies, and he actually wanted my grandfather to come out and work with him. But my grandfather was, he loved people, but he was kind of a homebody. He liked his football games on Sunday. At the time, of course, he loved ham radio. He had a huge shop. I loved it as a child. Yeah, glass tubes everywhere, you know, all that, you know, era technology, the smell of the 40s and 50s. You know, you figure this was deep in the heart of a bayou on, you know, in deep southern Louisiana, right out of New Orleans. And it was, you know, if you could vision this, he loved building radios, and he loved talking on his ham set, and watching football on the weekends.
But do you think, if you could imagine, what was he not saying? I mean, who knows? But what was he, I mean, if we can just play a little bit, what was he not wanting to say, even to his family, if you could imagine something pretty far out there?
Well, if I can do this, and I want to preface it that this is my opinion. This is what I think. He was made aware of the bodies and the biological material, and that that experience put him in a certain sense of peace about the world, about the universe, etc. But if I was to say that was the biggest thing. Now, obviously they're trying to assemble some of this material, all this crash debris. They're trying to make some sense of, you know, okay, this part goes here. That if we imagine, and we talked about within our family too, that some of the parts were structural. Some of it was a skin. Some of it was this and that and the other. And they were trying to compose what was a spacecraft, what drove it, and that kind of thing. But I really think he was kind of involved during that beginning period, again, my opinion, but I would stand by that, though.
Oh, so the mechanics of the craft, he got to know a bit about that.
And I think what was so amazing about it all is that I-beam that has certain writing. And what's interesting also is there was the encounter in Rendlesham Forest, one of the U.S. Bases that was there. And the man who went over to UFO and actually saw writing also
Pennison.
On it. Yeah, Pennison.
Yeah.
He was there at Citizens Hearing as well as your dad and yourself. Uh-huh. I would love to see the coordinationers. Was there any comparison or anything done with the writing whatsoever?
And Danny Sheehan also saw writing at the Pentagon of UFO craft.
That's an amazing story.
I wonder if this writing was similar on all these different crafts. Is there any comparison with that?
On Peniston's, I had a chance to talk with him in Ohio recently, and we were looking at the symbols and kind of comparing them. But there is actually one symbol, not absolutely, but very close. And what's interesting is the one symbol that kind of is comparable is one that my father as a child always talked about, a seal with a ball on his nose. That's how he described this symbol, and it really stuck in his mind. It was kind of a big thing.
With a ball on its nose, like a picture of a seal, the animal.
Yeah, but more picture that, you know, the outline, when it's actually drawn out, it's more like a pyramid with a sun over it or a sphere over the top of a pyramid. That was actually the most common symbol that they found in this, and it made the biggest impact with my father.
So I just want to clarify. You mentioned a seal. I was thinking like an animal.
Yeah.
But then you said pyramid. So was it a pyramid or a seal, or how does it, you know, how does that kind of just describe itself?
You know, in conversation with my father, he would say, as a child, he remembered it because it almost reminded him of a seal with a ball on its nose. But when he drew it out, is actually a pyramid with a sphere over the top of it.
I have to say that, you know, there was writing on the outside of the pyramid that Herodotus and some of the ancient legends talk about, and it wasn't Egyptian petroglyphs, and it was lost when that very shiny limestone, I think.
Alabaster.
Got lost in the earthquake. So it's very interesting. We would also like to see some of the
writing.
Yeah, comparisons.
Yeah, supposed to be E.T. writing on the outside of the Great Pyramid when it was covered in alabaster. And I think some of those stones are used at the Mosque of Ali in Cairo.
They're called the casing stones, if people want to look at it.
But there was alien writing that was also...
It was not Egyptian.
But even in the crop circles, I think from 2012, there was some interesting alien-looking writing. Did anything come up about that?
I spent a great deal of time looking at symbols just because that is one area that I'm very interested in. One thing about not only their shape, how each symbol seemed to be a progressive from one symbol to the next symbol. And also, they also had a property behind them. And if you're familiar with the story, when my grandfather brought the debris home and wanted to show his son, my father, of course, and his wife, before he brought it back to the base with the idea that it would probably disappear after that, my father held it up to a light and found that if you held the I-beam, if you look at it straight on, you wouldn't see anything on it, just a piece of metal. When you looked at it at an angle, these I-beam or these symbols would actually appear almost. They never said the word hologram, but the way it's described, it's like a hologram would all of a sudden appear, and that's where the symbols would come up. And
I wanted to contribute a little bit here because my background is in ancient languages and linguistics, and I remember talking to Michael Hazeman, who was a very renowned German investigator some years ago, and we were comparing the ideographic impressions on the I-beam through several documentaries that we were able to look at, and clearly the language patterns would resemble, on one hand, some of the Egyptian and some of the Greek, the archaic Greek, what is called the Koine or the Common Greek, but there were others that did not fit into a matrix of a given language system as such. And so it could very well be a system of instruction here to show a synthesis of, shall we say, influences. I think there's a website one can go to take a closer look at the
I-beam from Roswell.
So this is maybe you could describe a few of the shapes. Unfortunately, this is just radio, but it looks like, what is there, one with a almost a sphere with another smaller sphere on top of it? Is this just
If you want to, and I didn't go on this radio show to promote, but I'm working with this new company called TruthFunders.com. And they're basically a paranormal idea. If you want to try to produce a documentary that involves the paranormal, then they try to raise funds for you. And they actually have a project on there to make a bunch of these I-beams. But if anybody wants to go to truthfunders.com, you can look up my name, and you'll see all of the symbols there and the whole thing. And so if you have a chance, it's all sitting right there, and the pictures we talked about. But
So your father remembered the symbols, or was it your grandfather that remembered the symbols and wrote them out?
It was a combination of the two. My grandfather wrote them out, and my father wrote them out. And they're similar and they're dissimilar. There's a little bit of crossover. So what I did is I combined all the symbols and created a font out of them.
Font like an alphabet. You're saying? Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And you can get that. You can go on my site and you can download that font. But
The Roswell I-beam. What is the Roswell I-beam?
No, that's what his father saw when he
brought. Oh, but where do you find that on the internet?
No, this is under. Well, I'm looking under Truth Funders. So that's a great thing. Yeah.
It's basically we went through. I combined their symbols. My father's were a little more three dimensional than my grandfather's, a little more complicated. But he went through them all. I said, oh yeah, this is like this, this is that like that, and this is the best of their memory. But you know, my father was a very brilliant man along with my grandfather, so it's not too far to think these are fairly close. And I'd like to add in, and Dr. Tu, that it's interesting in that there's a Roger Weir. And he's a symbologist, a kind of interesting guy. I think it's Berkeley. We sat down and he studied him for months and months. And he kind of came to the conclusion that the symbols' meanings actually could be a map of some kind. And perhaps they're created through some kind of a process as they enter a new system or a planet. You know, maybe like, and it's always been kind of a kicked around the idea. Well, what if that pyramid with the ball over it is the Earth, you know. Except we're just postulating here, but it's just kind of fun to think about. It's the possibilities are amazing, and it's interesting that like I said on that site, you can see all the symbols. It'd be a lot of fun for everybody to take a close look. You know, who knows? Someone might discover something that you know we're missing. But I do feel there's a strong relevance towards some of this Egyptology, some of the you know ancient writings that you know perhaps came from this kind of thing, or this might be a universal language. You know, who knows? But it's quite interesting, intriguing to say the least.
And what's interesting is you know when you get down to Egyptology, oftentimes they say the symbol was really a sound, but in actuality, the very early symbols were actually you know formations that meant something. So I'm looking at this Roswell I-beam that you put out. And it has something that looks like a pillar, And mm-hmm. when we look at those kind of pillar situations where it's bigger on the top or on the bottom as well, it can be like a vortex energy where it's a way of going through hyperspace, for example. And then sure. there's one that looks like a cross. And Dr. Chek says, yep. We find this in ancient Chinese. A cross is?
Mm-hmm. Symbol of 10. Or it also can mean a symbol of space-time singularity. It's crossing a threshold. And finally, you find this in as a ubiquitous symbol in much of the ancient right. world. But I wanted to touch upon something that's quite provocative. And please forgive me, Jesse, if I'm pushing the
envelope. Oh, not at all.
But I know the son of a very famous general who was on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I won't mention the name because the son is still living. And he said that the EB who survived, there was one that did survive, was put under the tutelage or the direction of this one general. And then in more recent times, this EB wanted to be returned to his base of operations, but he had to be taken to the Middle East to a particular place and released. I know this sounds like an apocryphal story, and I basically
I consider
it apocryphal anyway, but for what it's worth, this would, if this was an area in Egypt, it would tie together really the threads of what many linguists first speculated in terms of a type of hypertext for Egyptian symbols within the context of the planetary environment.
But if we can go back to like why Roswell, I think that's really important. And for people who maybe haven't followed up on this, of course, there was an FBI memorandum.
The guy Huddle. But was that Roswell, or some people say that was in the other crash site,
But the idea was saying that that because we were starting to use certain radio frequencies, maybe that's one of the reasons why your dad really loved ham radios. Not that they were using ham radios, but certain frequencies that actually brought them down, that they, until they adjusted their spacecraft, they weren't able to, you know, occupy the space when we were sending some of these frequencies,
right.
caused them to crash.
Did your grandfather have an idea about that, the frequencies?
Or why they crashed?
Jesse, did we lose you? Jesse.
Okay.
I think the Skype has crashed.
Jesse. Doug, did we lose our guest? Doug.
Hello?
Oh, we lost for a second.
Oh, yeah. Oh no. Okay. There's been some problems all night. He took the view that obviously something went wrong, horribly wrong on their craft. And he never came to the exact conclusion of what could have caused it to happen. I mean, there was a lot of sightings of numerous UFOs, not just this one, of course. There was a lot of them going through town, over town. A lot of the townspeople talked about these amazing blue orb-type lights that would fly over town and over the streets of Roswell back then. And some nuns talked about it. My dad even said, as a kid, he poked his head out the back window one time and saw one fly by. So there was a lot of things going on in that area at the time. And, you know, some people have postulated maybe two crashed together, you know, possibly. But my grandfather, the biggest thing he said about that is that it made sense that these beings, whatever they were, crash in a very desolate area so they wouldn't destroy human life.
Oh,
that was his take on it. So not exactly what you're looking for, but that's kind of how he put it.
But actually, that confirms something. We had a very good friend who eventually worked for Jet Propulsion Lab, but he also was in that area as an engineer. And he said, they saw so much that they just considered we lived on the Earth and they lived in the sky. He said that's what people understood. All the scientists saw that at that time. And then, of course, you don't see it anymore.
White Sands.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Edgar Mitchell was born in Roswell as well.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But, you know, talking to your father, maybe it was 5 years ago, he said later in his life he was visited by some men who asked him if he remembered anything else about what he saw as a child. And were you ever visited, or was your grandfather, I guess he was always like in a way a company man. Did he like have regular contact, or what's been that experience in the family with like suppressed information and visits and all that? Do you have any history?
Well, to the point where at one time our family was actually offered protection from the government. So we grew up knowing, like I said, it sounds conspiratorial, but it's really not. We grew up knowing that what we said and what we did was being watched, just examples, and it wasn't being hidden. I talk the story quite often. My father put together a little vacation for us down in Disneyland. Got off the phone talking to, at the time, my mother, and then like 30 seconds later, he's being called on the phone saying, doctor, we understand you're going to be staying at the XYZ in room number 32 in a week and a half, and we'd like to come talk to you.
Wow.
And it, to the point where we knew, I mean, this is his office phone, but just knowing that whatever he said and was doing was being scrutinized very, very closely. And, you know, we grew up, you know, and, you know, who knows if it's all real, but yeah, I mean, the phones always had strange noises. We pretty much knew that we grew up with that. And my grandfather, he became comfortable with that to a point, but then later on in his life, he gave an interview. And to a college student down in Houma, who was interested in the subject matter, just happened to find out he was a neighbor down the street of his, and he gave a kind of a basic interview, nothing out of the ordinary, pretty much what was available at the time, and he called her back completely frightened.
Your grandfather called her back frightened.
Right. Yeah. My grandfather called her back very frightened and said, "Please do not publish this. Don't talk about it. Don't say anything about that. You've interviewed me." And this is actually the time when the story kind of cooled off. And I, you know, again, if I'm allowed to think about this out loud a little bit,
sure.
I think that somebody came and put the thumb down on him and said, you know, that this is done. You're bringing it back out again. And that caused him to call. Now, he was older, you know, later on in life, and, you know, I don't think he was so much worried about himself, but he was worried about his descendants, his family, his son, you know, that kind of thing. But they scared the heck out of him. I mean, there was no question. He was – that whatever happened, whatever they did scared him, and then he died almost – or pretty much suddenly right after that.
Really? He died suddenly? You think there was some strange thing that happened to him?
I don't know, but it's kind of peculiar. I mean, whatever happened, and it happened to my father too, though. But literally, there was no there wasn't like, you know, a heart attack, go to the hospital. No, it was instantaneous. And my father the same way, instantaneous.
You think the government took out? Well, I don't know about your father, but you think the government? Well, I mean, I don't know if you want to come out and say that, but
yeah, I know. I mean, we're just talking, but yeah, you know, it's.
Let's just say, if we go back also to the time of why this was so important around that period, is of course there was the nuclear testing done in the area, and we think that that is why, of course, why the aliens were coming to the area to see what we were doing technologically. And we feel from our research, even some of our spaceships going up towards Mars and stuff, the ones that have had some nuclear power, sometimes they don't make it. So we think, in a sense, we have been being watched for a long time. We're talking about the government watching, but we're also talking about the extraterrestrials watching and seeing, you know, who we are, how we're developing, and what's going on. I think that that's something also to be said. That,
right. But have you ever had any strange experiences from government people, if you want to share? I don't know.
For me, that's about it. I mean, just other than we were aware that people were watching us, but nothing strange. I mean, nobody inhibited our daily life. I mean, we weren't stopped from doing something. It's just, but we were aware that what my father was saying was being listened to, and of course, that, you know, that boils down to our home and that kind of thing. So it was it wasn't nobody was scared, so to speak. But it was interesting when my father was offered protection for his family, but.
Who was he offering protection against, though? I mean,
part of our government is being funded through taxes to do cover-ups, and that was he met with these people, and they're Senate appropriate. What they were doing was they were trying to figure out why in the world and how in the world tax dollars were being drained to cover up Roswell. The story wasn't about Roswell. In fact, they thought the people he met with said it was real, but the whole point was that. These tax dollars are somehow going to this agency within the government that nobody could get to, and that was basically if we needed safety from that agency that exists within our government.
Well, it seems like thank you. But it seems like you're giving you've been given free rein to talk about what you want. And do you feel like there's been a change in this internal government that now it's okay to come out with this stuff? What's your feeling?
My feeling is the government has done it such a good job, and the media has been so quick to follow and scrutinize any stories that basically the media has taken over. The government doesn't need to do it anymore. The media will make fun of you if you come out and talk about it, although that's changing. But I think for quite a while in the 90s, if you talked about UFOs, you're just crazy. you know, and the media treated you like that, and the and you know most of the documentaries and that kind of thing came out and basically made fun of you, and so they did a better job than the government could have done. They did, right. You know, they minimized you through the media. Things have changed, though. I mean, you know, ever since, you know, like, you know, obviously people know Ancient Aliens, that kind of thing, but it's becoming, it's moved to the forefront, and I think it's getting to the point where a lot of people talk about are we actually on the brink of disclosure? And it sure seems like it.
And this is why we talked when we were together in Brazil last year of the importance of putting together a course of study to distinguish the real substance of this new science of what you would call UFO/ET/UT altered terrestrial research, as opposed to what has come down through the Apocrypha, through the laughter curtain, and also through the fear curtain, because people in the younger generation of Spielberg and Dykstra and other specialists in special effects and film know that we have a different, more scientifically oriented, younger generation that's really equipped emotionally and cognitively to put the pieces together. The sociological, the historical are fine, but you need to look at the impact this will have on society and overcome it where the naysayers who think that people are not intelligent, who really see the blue sky and what is beyond the blue sky.
You know, what's interesting also is we've talked to other people who have had direct encounters either with beings or with at least seeing close encounters of the second kind, if not the third kind. And it does something to change the consciousness. And recently, actually, in Carmel, California, there was a flotilla of vehicles seen overhead. This is similar to what was seen some years back in Guadalajara and also in Peru. So what you were saying in Lima, Peru, by the way, there were so many that, and it lasted for so long that even the news media with the televisions were able to get out and capture and talk to people who were watching it live and everything. So we do think we're in a kind of phase of transformation. But with that said, I'd like to say that you also have been kind of transformed because your regular business, can we talk about that as well? When Alan and I were Googling and getting your information together, you're looking at actually flying as well, right?
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Tell us about your flying car situation and how much it might be connected to your past or not.
Well, you know, it's basically, you know, I a very short. I grew up. My father was a very brilliant man, a medical doctor, but he was also a physicist, a very brilliant guy. So we grew up. It's kind of a joke, but it wasn't. We grew up. He built an atom smasher in the basement. Just all these kind of things. So not what you consider a typical childhood. Huge observatory in the backyard. So I was kind of indoctrinated in that area. So I've always been kind of taught a way to, you know, think about things and have a kind of an understanding. And I credit that to my father completely. And just out of that, I kind of developed a machine, a bias drive that basically it splits gravitational forces in a way that still meets physics, but it's able to create a biased force anyway. But I needed a platform to test my studies, and I thought, well, you know, it'd be nice to have like a slang term of flying car. It's actually called a personal air vehicle to test those on. So I thought, well, if you're gonna have one, you might as well make it kind of cool looking. So I studied, you know, the aerodynamics and then came up with kind of a new design and went through all the patent process, that kind of thing, for a flying car. And I've been raising eyebrows all over the world. Actually, I have entire universities to astronauts to you name it, to one of the biggest extreme drink makers in the world is now on wants to become partners. So it's been a lot of fun, but it's going like crazy. It's taking off.
What do you mean by a flying car? What's the propulsion mechanism that makes it fly? How does it fly?
It just pushes air around. The main propulsion is a gyroscope that creates thrust through pushing air. So it's like a hybrid. So the center of it's a gyroscope, so it keeps it completely stable and very, you know, level, very easy, very very safe to fly, that kind of thing. But yet that provides the vertical component of its thrust.
I mean, how high does it fly? Cars?
Well, it's not pressurized, so you wouldn't want to go over 25,000 feet. But there isn't really a limit. It's not a hovercraft by any means. It's a vertical takeoff and landing vehicle, small enough to park in your garage. If you want, I just have an informational website. It's called airbornemotors.com. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go on there, you can check it out. If you if you want to kind of keep up with it, there's I have a little newsletter. We're going to be coming out with a documentary all about the flying car, and some of the technologies involved.
Let's say there was a fleet of these. How high would these fly? I mean, if these could get out on the road, I mean, does it go like a car as well? And you have the hover mechanism or something?
I mean, you could. I mean, it would you would be able to pilot it down the road almost like a hovercraft if you wanted to. But really, it's small and compact. You park it in your garage, you pull in your driveway, and you take off. So there isn't a whole lot of reason to actually go in within traffic. It doesn't take any place to, it can land in the footprint. It's in a 12-by-12-foot square you could land it. So it's not like you need a big field or landing strip to do it to fly it.
This is like the Jetsons, right?
That's people. I've done a lot of radio interviews, and they've been playing that in the background. The Jetsons, and also what's another one? Back to the Future. This is an anniversary of the flying car. So it's been a lot of fun. But
but this is not a theory. This is something that's actually working.
How
proven proven technology. No, it's not. It's the body of the car actually generates a magnetic field that creates the rotation in the main rotor, which is the gyroscope to propel it. So it's basically applying technology that exists just in kind of a different way.
So you haven't actually tested it yet on a large scale, maybe on a toy model scale, or
we have printed models and that kind of thing. And then of course, software is so wonderful. Inventor software and SolidWorks and the rest of it. You can go through and do almost all your testing completely on a computer. So right now we're just in the phase of starting construction for a full scale model. So wow. One that we can test fly and all that kind of thing. So that's what we're in the process of doing right now.
Dr. Chuck and I are founders of the Academy for Future Science, so we're always interested in looking at this. And the idea of an electromagnetic motor, of course, has been around for a long time.
Sure.
In terms of trying to get free energy, as well as maybe mimicking what extraterrestrial vehicles may use. So I think it is the next phase for all of us. I mean, we're evolving so quickly right now, and I think that the aliens there, have shown us. I mean, we back engineered some things. If you consider Robert Lanza or Bob Lazar, for an example. But in addition to that, I mean, your whole consciousness being raised with this, it just shows you where we can go.
I wanted to say, some years ago, I had a chance to meet with and get to know an inventor by the name of Christopher Fisher, who was one of the great minds behind the first supercomputer. In fact, Seymour Cray, founder of the Cray computer, took his ideas, and Christopher took him to court and won. But he was working with Avro Avionics in Canada after World War II. He was a young German engineer, and he claimed that they developed a hovercraft that could go to 60,000 feet, really within a very short amount of time. Because of the significance of this on the military chain of command, it was decided to simply come up with film showing the hovercraft no more than a couple meters off the Earth's surface. But he said there was a lot more that was done, and what we see as flying saucers were really a lot of the German technology that was further developed in Canada and the United States. So that being said, we know you're on the right side of future aviation. We know that there are many things that have been on the back burner for some 60-some years that are now coming out.
Yep.
And 2015, 16, and 17, I believe we'll see really the advancement of the whole state of the art.
Mm-hmm.
We will really claim an opportunity of building not only human habitats, but having our own, quote-unquote, man-made flying saucers to go to and fro.
This is incredible. I mean, how long do you think it will take to have it take off? That's a joke, but it's also serious.
My goal is by the end of this year as an anniversary that we have one you could fly in. It's not going to be one that is testable that somebody could sit in and fly around in. That's my goal right now.
And if you mass produce this, how much you think each craft would cost on the market?
The first ones would be really expensive, $100,000 plus. But and it has to do with the batteries and that kind of thing. But as technology progresses, there's no reason why it'd be more expensive than a compact car.
This is incredible. This is really the future. I mean, I think we can make this work. I mean,
it's exciting. As an aside, it's kind of funny because a lot of people think, well, what aliens beam this idea in your head? But I said, well, I wouldn't know if they did. But, if they want to, go right ahead.
I mean, it would be pretty phenomenal that, here, the grandson of Jesse Marcel, the Roswell guy, creates a technology of flying machine. So it's a perfect production setup, really.
Yeah, and it's all based, and it's not like it's, you know, well, like I said, it's based on a gyroscope. The fundamental force that keeps this thing flyable or keeps things safe and easy to use is a gyroscope, and it's never been used this way.
I want to invest in it.
Well, go on, sign up for my newsletter. Let's talk. But it's exciting. I mean, it's really one of those things that I've had the idea to, you know, I'm scratching it out on paper for, you know, decades, 15, 20 years. But it's now technology in some of those areas like battery density energy is high enough that you can actually make this feasible. So it's really all coming together right now.
I mean, do you see, like, in the next 10 years, people will be having these flying cars to drive around the highway?
It all depends. What I was talking about, you know, there's going to have to be some kind of a corridor system set up, an aerial corridor system to navigate traffic. It's fun to think about, okay, so if I'm going to get from my house, I'm going to go park in a parkade. Well, almost in science fiction, but it's not science fiction. Okay, once I become within a certain distance of a parkade, a computer control system that parkade is going to grab hold of your car and park it for you. And you want to leave, it's also going to grab your car and it's going to control it, fly it out to a certain point, and then you're going to take off again. But like all these are technologically, I mean, we have that technology today to do that kind of thing. But, you know, there's GPS, it'll know when anything is, it's a proximity detector, so it'll know if you're getting close to something or too close to something like that, you're moving too fast, and, you know, all these sort of things. And because of the gyroscope, and it's based on if something happens and you're losing, whatever happened, you're trying to lose control, you just let go of all the controls and let the car get restabilize itself.
Wow, that's exciting. You know, we come from Silicon Valley and they already have the Google driverless car, but you need all the technologies around there to make sure you don't crash or no one can crash into you and all that stuff.
Same technology. Yep,
you
exactly
should talk
the same.
To Harrison Ford. Maybe he needs something like this instead of airplanes.
I'm just the beginning. You mentioned that, but we are actually just opening it up for stock investment if people want to get involved. But it is moving forward. I've raised a lot of eyebrows. Everybody's looking at it because, you know, people are all flying car. Yeah, whatever. It's like, but people see this and they're absolutely amazed. So I'm excited that it's liked.
There's the Harrier jet that, you know, the British have used for a long time, and that has at least the same stabilizer idea, I'm sure. And, we all want to be there when you're going to be, showing it off. So this is going
to
be awesome.
Love to have you at the original release. Well, like, and you know, also, this also uses quadcopter technology. So we're throwing it. It's all, yeah, but as far as being there, if you guys want to be aboard, you're sure welcome to do it. So.
On the ground. Good.
What is the mechanism that fuels it? Is it electric?
All electric. Yep, all electric. Completely
electric. Store the energy in batteries, and how fast and how far could you go? How fast and
far? It just depends on how far you want to design it. It's, you know, right now, you know, it wouldn't be more than 30 or 40 minutes of flight time. But that can be expanded to 3 or 4 hours depending on the flight or depending on the batteries. And the technology, you know, like Elon Musk has come out with a denser package and a battery just recently. There's fuel cells that are coming out. So really, you know, it's a limiting factor today. Within a year, it's going to be a lot less limited. You know, it's going to be. In fact, I think in the next several years, it'll be absolutely limitless. There's not going to, you know, they're working on batteries that'll power your whole house. You know, that kind of thing. And that's just right around the corner.
Right, and I was going to say this is the perfect technology for Elon Musk because he did Tesla. Now that's moving to Toyota as well, a joint project, and he has SpaceX. So he needs something in between the electric car and the flying to space. This is a perfect thing for him. Hopefully, he'll get involved.
It'd be interesting. It's all there.
Well, how fast would it go, and what would be the crash-proof mechanism in a car like this?
You have sensors, actually.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, in a way, it's so stable that it flies itself, and when you put up input in, you're destabilizing it to turn it, and then when you turn back in, it's going to become stable again. So the biggest thing is it'll want to fly. Now, if something goes wrong, if something is, you know, some reason it's all of a sudden losing a lot of energy real fast, it'll land itself. Wow. And in the absolute most extreme of situation, there is a rocket propelled parachute that'll land it that way. If everything was to go get locked up for
That's
some reason, just it's the last case.
The parachute.
And so, how fast does it go?
You know, it depends on the design. What's different about this, if people are looking at it, you know, how a quadcopter goes, the corners of this vehicle are what may go left, right, forward, or backward, and the main center rotor goes up and down. Well, these are actually rotatable, so you can rotate the other fans are involved and go forward. And then it just depends on, okay, the fans turn at almost, you know, a certain RPM, how much energy is being pushed. So, you know, it's, you know, 150 miles an hour, if that's what you want to do, if you want to design it that way. I didn't design it that way for speed. I designed it really for something that you'll fly, you know, not much higher than the power lines, or even, you know, if you're in an open, desolate area, 5 feet off the ground, like a sports car almost. You know, at almost like speed you'd fly in a car, 85 miles an hour, that sort of thing. It's capable of a lot more, but, you know, that really design is more for you know, something that's not going to get you in too much trouble.
And in fact, it sounds like it's safer than the UFOs at Roswell. So
no, I think so.
It's safer than the car on the street.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not a question of if, it's when. You know, obviously we're in a budding sense that the era of a personal air vehicle is coming around the corner. It's coming out of science fiction and coming into reality. And there's going to be a point not too far in the distance. I mean, imagine if we can eradicate a lot of those spaces through, you know, cities, the highway systems. I mean, they're huge. If those can be turned into parks and we have flying cars, just imagine the difference. Our life, okay. Or how much improved our life would be.
Yeah, we worked a bit with the idea that actually they've done studies that more and more people are going to be living in cities all over the world. So like 75% of the people on the planet, sadly enough, are going to live in cities. But you have to then get higher densities. So in this case, you could fly right into your apartment. You know, you don't have to go into the ground. This is going to be exciting.
Or to your roof, at least.
Yeah,
your roof, you know, the landing pad outside your window. You know, I mean, it's really all there. You know, and like I said, it's not crazy speak. It's all right within the realm of technology. So,
well, this is the positive side of the whole story we're talking about. Not cops and robbers or intrigues of government men in black. We're talking about space futures, the ability that we will claim citizenship on the high frontier, build habitats in space, have an exo-industrial, exo-medical, exo-sociological side of life that will finally blossom after centuries of dualism and what we will call the misunderstanding of how one part of the human psyche works in terms of constructive rather than destructive technology.
And from looking at the reports of other people who have had encounters, this is in some cases what the aliens want us to do. They want us to evolve to be a space-faring civilization, to be able to advance, you know, get off the horse and buggy. And I think some of the technology, even the simple cars and stuff, some of this has come through inspiration from some of these other levels of technology. I mean, we've done a lot ourselves. You're doing a lot here with putting this car together. It's not coming necessarily from an alien technology, but with the concept of what we can be like in the future.
But it is strange, Jesse, that you are the inheritor of the Roswell tradition, and you're changing probably the future of the planet if this really takes off. And this is a game changer, and it's major.
It will. I mean, the car, it's not even if. The car is going to exist. The car will do what we want it to do. I mean, so it's just, I'll tell you, it's an exciting place to be. That's all I can say. It's a very exciting place to be.
Yes, exciting.
And it would
time.
Suggest that the aliens who were visiting left behind were a code of information to inspire us to see the spacefaring aspect of reclaiming the openness and the whole upward thrust of evolution.
That's a beautiful thought. He's exactly right.
Side of the story.
I mean, do you feel a connection to aliens, alien consciousness, or is it just something that you put up with?
if you're talking to me, you know, in my personal life, I'm very open to it.
Right.
I'm obviously there isn't a trace of disbelief in my soul in any sense of the form that there aren't other beings, you know, that there's other life forms out there that are more advanced than us and that they do want to help us, and that obviously they want to help us to the point where we wouldn't destroy ourselves because of new technology, that kind of thing. But I'm very hopeful that there's some truth to that. that there's some influence happening there, you know. So I don't know, but it's an exciting thought. To me, it's all very positive.
You've never seen a ship yourself, anything or anything strange. Yeah.
I and my father and brother did when we were younger, and the reason we knew what we were looking at wasn't something from behaved like an aerial anomaly or a UFO, that kind of thing, is it because it moved too erratically to be an airplane. It was not a helicopter, but it could change its direction, that kind of thing, in ways that nothing we have could do what it did.
So it's not inconsistent that these events happen in Roswell near White Sands, where the V-2s and the upper tests were made that led to the finding of the Van Allen belt. It's not inconsistent that in the close to the Trinity site where the atomic bomb was first tested, that a positive message or event could be left behind, that there is another way of looking at evolution.
But it's also not inconsistent that people who have an open mind to really accept these other levels of intelligence will often also see them. And, you know, some people say, well, I won't believe until, you know, I hear from the government. But the other people who do have an open mind oftentimes do have an encounter.
And also invent a technology that will further evolve human civilization. Yeah. So, there you go. But we have one more interesting Roswell item to ask you about.
And perhaps the most important that is coming out into public discussion, the so-called slides.
Or the Kodachrome.
That were found here recently in Sedona, Arizona, where we presently are, talking to some ufologists to, shall we say, retrace the steps that led to the finding of a box of slides, of which, of course, there were literally a score, perhaps as many as 400 slides that went back to the
40s
and the event of the so-called true Roswell story.
Yeah, but there was only two slides that are of interest. And I think we've talked to you a little bit about this, that you're not convinced. And in a sense, even though they're now called the Roswell slides, there's no evidence except for the period of time that they were actually connected with Roswell.
So do you know what we're talking about, and what do you think?
That old X-Files, I want to believe. There's some question, the little bit of information I know about them, a couple things don't seem to fit exactly right, but that doesn't seem as not true. And it's more like I don't have enough information to make an informed opinion.
What doesn't fit that's not right?
Well, let me get the backstory first. Yeah. The backstory is that in recent times, evidence was gathered from the files of a Hilda Bear Ray and her husband, Bernard, who was a famous geologist from Midland, Texas, who had retired out here in the Sedona area.
She retired.
And this was kept in, shall we say, a holding area for some time. It was sequestered, and suddenly when the house cleaner came through,
After she died,
she recognized there were many famous pictures, movie stars, and famous actors of the mid-40s in this collection of strange slides, of which there were two that stood out, and that suggested a closer inspection, which showed a large-faced ET-type subject.
Yeah, a large head, yeah. So it's two slides out of this collection of many, many, many slides that have an appearance of an alien, a small alien with a large head, very small body. So this is what came out of these slides. And now Jaime Maussan, who's a close associate of Dr. Hrdek and mine, on May 5th is going to be releasing this in Mexico City, because the slides themselves, with the exception of a few personal friends that have seen this, have not been released publicly.
But I want to know what inconsistencies you know, because we're all just putting our opinion out there. But what do you think, Jesse?
Oh, it's just, you know, I talked to some people that were in the military that did a lot of photography work back then, and they said that, okay, if they were a military project whatsoever, it would have been done on 35mm. It would have been done like on a 4x6 format. But that doesn't mean that the 35mm did exist at the time. It really came into its own about 15 years later. But so it could fit. And if it was a camera that was snuck in somehow, pictures were taken with a private camera, that kind of thing, it would have been very hard to hide. So whoever did it obviously had to be involved to some level to being allowed to take those kind of pictures. But it's kind of the wrong kind of equipment. But again, you know, that doesn't mean anything. It just means that it puts up a question mark. It's not even a red flag. It's just like, well, these things have to be gone through. As far as I could tell, they what the little bit of information I have on them, which is whatever I can get to on the internet, basically. I mean, they have you know, they smell authentic. They have that look, you know. And I said, and it's not that it's out of the realm of possibility by any means. So all I can say is for myself that I'm very hopeful that it's there's something to it. You know, right, that there's actually something to it.
So one of the bodies looks like it's in a glass case. But if we can just go back for a minute, your knowledge of Roswell, that there at least you said some, we'll say, life form found even in the wreckage. But your knowledge, not maybe from your father, but just from your own research, how many life forms were found probably or were encountered at Roswell?
You know, I, and this isn't from my information, but the going story is 4. And that there's actually some precedent to that, but it's also, you know, there's also some logical reasons. Obviously, if this was either something that flew all the way here, was part of a bigger craft, it kind of makes sense. Even if we look back at, I mean, how many people are space shuttles of yore, that kind of thing. So it's not definitely not out of the realm. You would think there would be 4 passengers. Those things kind of fit. And as bad as the accident was, you know, about one of them living or several of them living, one of them, you know, not making it, that kind of thing, it all does fit quite well. And then the original crash scene, it was just – there was some biological debris. My grandfather was back, you know, at that point. They were saying, you know, I don't know if it was a cow that was hit or if it was an alien or what it was. But there was some of that – some in there. There was actually some – I think it's a National Geographic video on YouTube that actually goes into that a little bit better. But
the FBI memo from 1950 said there were – 3 crafts, each having 3 bodies, so that would be 9 creatures. And then Edgar Mitchell also talked about them making little coffins to bury the bodies that were about.
Yes. 3.
So I don't know. Some people say 9. Some people say who knows. I mean, but
there were 3 caskets. I mean, there is truth to the 3 caskets. There were 3 small, you know, 4-foot or less caskets that were made and brought onto the base. Mm-hmm. So there's absolute truth to that. So if you take those 3, and then there's the one that was, you know, that as the story goes, it was wandering the halls at one point, you know, kind of on the loose, you know, so to speak, would account for 4. And that, you know, that was just one part of the story, of course. But yes,
well,
we're interested in this because I had a background doing private consulting work with JPL and image enhancement analysis, and I ran into a chap who was with the military. Back in 1947, in the area where there was a film that was made by the U.S. military of the specimen being shown and to test the reaction of military personnel at the time, and he said no other cameras were allowed except what we would call the standard large cameras of that era. So it's hard to conceive of specialized slides getting out in wider circulation. I'm just saying this from the standpoint of those individuals I've talked to who decry the slides as being authentic. On the other hand, with the testimony of Astron Mitchell and other heavy duty pioneers in space who've seen and have examined under closer detail all of the intriguing smaller and finer details, there seems to be an impetus to accept this as the real authentic film signature. So again, we wanted to run this by you because one of my students, and I have property out there near Aztec, New Mexico, a father's brother was Mr. Davy Jones, and he knew the mayor. He had a gas station at the time in the Roswell area and said that the cows had aborted the night of the crash and gave some interesting details of the biological specimens never before discussed. I'm not sure saying that we're going to discuss it on this program tonight, but there are other details of a much larger story that I feel are too important to be put down to the microscopic details of 2 slides. And I think we would err if we would simply build a whole Roswell story around a couple of slides rather than looking all of the information that we've talked about to this point, namely the psychological, the sociological, the metallurgical, the linguistic, and even the possibility that there was something more to the story of things deliberately left behind for the human race to discover, to entertain, and to acquaint itself with in terms of a re-encounter with those who were behind the original event of ET, interpenetration of human airspace.
Well, and that's Dr. Hertog and Dr. Desiree Hertog, who've been researching this field for a long, long time with many discoveries themselves. But one more thing before we wrap up. You said there's a special celebration happening this year in Roswell. You want to talk about that for the Roswell celebration?
Yes, Don Schmidt on Friday morning, I think it's the 3rd of July, is going to be putting a special together for my father, kind of a tribute for him passing away and all that he did to help further the study of ufology and aliens and that kind of thing. So that's going to be going on. We're going to be down there. I'm going to be down there for about a week, just, you know, doing the panels and giving some speeches and that kind of thing. If you can stop by, please come by and say hello. But yeah, we're hoping to really do a really nice tribute to my father.
Right. I mean, for people who don't know, every year Roswell has, what is it, like a 3-day celebration about the latest UFO research and the history in the past. Is that what happens? I was never in Roswell, but.
Yep, that's exactly what happens. If you want to catch up on the latest Roswell information, and not just Roswell, there's a lot of people in town that you can learn a lot about whatever the latest, greatest thing is going on. But it's really quite, it's actually a lot of fun. The town is, it greatly increases in population over the weekend, you know, 3 or 4-fold. But it's nice. They do a really good job of it. You can go visit the museum, take a look at some of the exhibits.
What's that? Yeah. It's a UFO museum in Roswell?
Yeah, the UFO museum. Yes, it's worth the drive. It's a little hard to get to, and there's an airport in Roswell too. But it's really worth it if you're interested in this sort of thing and you want to spend a couple of fun days. I couldn't recommend it higher.
Great. And there's probably your website, Roswell Celebration or something like that.
Yeah, also there's a museum.
Yeah, there's just that UFO.
Museum. But so if people want to get in touch with you, Jesse, or find out about your work, what should they do? Where should they look?
I have airbornemotors.com. And I have, there's emails, even my phone number is there. You're welcome to call me. I'm pretty easy guy to get hold of. There's also jessemarcel.com. And I just have some, you know, the books I write and DVDs, that sort of thing on there, and a little bit about the iBeam. So pretty easy. That's if you want to get a hold of me, go right there.
Well, I just want to talk about your father a little bit because, you know, of course, Please. Your grandfather. But tell people, I mean, I thought your father was a great person. Just give us a little background on your father's work. I mean, as a doctor and everything he's done.
Well, he was a very kind man. I remember as a child, just real quickly, going door to door with his little black bag, you know, back in the day. He was also one of those doctors that if there's a child that came to see him in his office and he needed a pair of shoes, he'd get them next time he showed up. And my dad would have him sitting there. Later on, talk about the guy behind my father, he would, back when AIDS happened, back when it started, he would, if there was somebody in the hospital he was taking care of that had AIDS, he'd sit there all night long with them.
Wow. And he also went to Iraq, didn't he? Go overseas
a
couple of
times. Out of medicine, he was a medical doctor. He was a colonel in the military. He went to Iraq. He was the oldest. He was a flight surgeon, the oldest flight surgeon, or the oldest colonel, basically, in Iraq. He was 72 years old. Very proud of him. He was out there. He was actually offered, if you want to stay for another year, they're going to make him a brigadier. But he decided to come home. But he had a strong military career. He was a doctor, and he was also a brilliant physicist.
Well, Desiree and I are very proud to have a picture of the three of us together. And we salute your father and your grandfather as being the true pioneers of the Fuller's story of human evolution into space, crossing what I would call the mental space barrier, and realizing that we are part of a evolutionary process that has brought together an infinite way, an infinite specieshood, and an infinite mind of glory into the human experience.
No, and thank you, because there is a lot of integrity within your family. I mean, they hold a place of integrity. Your grandfather stood up for the truth, and your mm-hmm. father and you. So,
and I also want to mention his sister is very proactive too.
Very proactive.
So thank you for being such dedicated truth seekers and contributing, like Dr. Hertog said, to the evolution of consciousness.
And
here.
This is so important, Jesse, that we move ahead to defining a whole curriculum based mm-hmm. upon the higher knowledge, the holistic knowledge of the subject that moves into the philosophical, the psychological, as well as the spiritual dimensions.
Yeah. And so it's very exciting. It's all coming together. I mean, I'm doing my radio work. The Hertogs are doing their work. You're doing your work. So I think the planet as a whole, and the healers here, they're uplifting. We're moving into a very grander time, I think, as a planetary civilization. That's what I think.
Agree. It's an exciting time to be alive. And thank you for talking about that. I mean, I think my grandfather and father, if they want to be remembered, if they could be remembered for being part of the evolution, the advancement of our humanity to a more open world, I think they'd like to be remembered that way. So.
And you're continuing the tradition. So thank you for spending all this time with us here on the radio.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for also the great work that you're doing, and hopefully will be continued in all parts of the world that hear this message, that we are part of a homo universalis, a universal humanity, waking up to the vast, awesome nature of our living universe.
Mm. So it's all very exciting for me. The past with your grandfather and the future with what you're doing, it's just phenomenal, and it represents a hope that something is possible for human civilization.
Yeah, even a flying car.
Even a flying car.
That's it. That's the future. That's the future. So, okay, I'll be in touch. Hope to see you again if you're ever in New York.
Yes.
You can always call me. You could email newrealities@earthlink.net. It's my website, newrealities.com.
And our website is futurescience.org. So look that up as well.
I'm going to take you up. I spent a lot of time in the city working on some film with a partner, so I'll definitely do that.
Oh, definitely do that. We'll come down to the studio and do a whole show about flying cars, okay?
Oh, that'd be fun. Yes, it's a deal. Let's do it.
Let's do it. When are you going to be there again?
I think we have some meetings definitely in the next 3 to 4 weeks. I'll be down there. We'll be there for a few days, so.
All right. Definitely call me, or I'll send you a little Skype thing with my phone number so you can call me after.
Please do. That'd be great. Yeah, go ahead and do that. I'll be excited. Yeah, I'll definitely go out there and we can all sit down. That'd be wonderful.
All right. Thanks for being a guest. And I've been talking to Jesse Marcel III, the inheritor, I would say, of the Roswell tradition. His grandfather was the one who picked up the wreckage in Roswell 1947 and showed it to his father, Jesse Marcel Jr., and now Jesse Marcel III is really, in a sense, holding that focus strong that Roswell did happen, and that we can move into a future with this awareness. So I've been talking also here with co-hosting with the Hertogs, Drs. JJ and Desiree Hertog from the Academy for Future Science. They're actually doing a big conference this weekend in Phoenix, and you can find out about that at futurescience.org.
And you're also promoting Contact in the Desert.
Right. I'm also promoting upcoming this May 29th. I'll be hosting, emceeing one of the stages at Contact in the Desert with really the top UFO researchers, Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolan, Stanton Freeman will be. If you're interested, if this subject is really exciting to you, because I know it is for us here, come to Contact and we'll have a great time. And we've been hosted by here in Sedona by Aurora. You have any final words to say, Aurora? This is our host.
Well, I'm very honored to hear all of this, and blessings to you, and good luck in the future endeavors. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. It's always fun to be here on BBS Radio with Don and Doug, and I'm happy we have a chance to put this kind of work and message out there. So if you want to contact me, go to my website, newrealities.com, or email me at newrealities.com. Thanks for listening. Good night.